Culture is the pulse of life. That aspect of life which shapes our thinking and acting.
As we know, cultures are not homogeneous. There are internal paradoxes, differences, and contradictions in all cultures.
Imagine what culture means to you.
Today on Arts and Letters, we'll be talking with Avinash Tambre, a communication professor at the Department of Applied Communication, the University of Arkansas at Little Rock, and Ramesh N. Rao, professor of communication at Columbus State University in Georgia. Their book, Intercultural Communication, The Indian Context, published by Sage Publications, introduces us to the challenges of and opportunities for communicating across a myriad of verbal and nonverbal differences in India, including
its culture,
its history,
its formation of intercultural identity,
and its cultural conflicts.
Intercultural Communication, The Indian Context, on Arts and Letters.
With a population of more than a billion Hindus, Muslims, Sikhs, Christians, and Jains, who speak 14 major languages and are characterized by pronounced regional and linguistic identities, any attempt to generalize what is an Indian identity formation is problematic.
From the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, I'm J. Bradley Minnick, and welcome to Arts and Letters, a program providing opportunities for the celebration of the arts and humanities. Today we'll be talking with communication professors Avinash Tambre and Ramesh Rao about their book, Intercultural Communication, The Indian Context.
India is a multifaceted, multicultural nation.
And it's also the second most populous country in the world and the world's largest democracy.
The birthplace of four religions whose people speak hundreds of languages and many more dialects, making it really a Tower of Babel.
And with a rich tradition and practice of ethnic, religious, and linguistic features.
Communication professors Avinash Tambre and Ramesh N. Rao, welcome.
Thank you, Brad, for having us on your show.
Thank you, Brad.
This book helped me think in very different ways. I like how it helped me think about the world, recognizing that people are not so different, but also recognizing some of the cultural ways that we think about being and living and working with people from different cultures. And I'm just wondering, why did you guys write this book, aside from your scholarly aspirations?
Well, there's an interesting story behind that. And Ramesh and myself, we were in San Francisco, I think, in about 2007 or 2008. We were attending the National Communication Association conference. And after presenting our papers together on a panel, both of us started talking about the need for intercultural communication literature and research. And there's a lack of it, Ramesh was telling me, and we need to do something about it. So we decided to write this book.
How about you, Ramesh?
Well, I have now been teaching in the U.S. for 30 years, and having taught intercultural communication and looked at and used a variety of textbooks, I realized that most of the books have been written from a Western scholarly perspective, a Western context. And I realized, too, that there is something that we can both draw from in terms of the field as it is shaped here in the West and in the United States, and how that can also be used in the Indian context, because the communication field in India, maybe to this day, focus mostly on journalism and mass communication. There is not very much of a separate field of communication in Indian universities, in Indian higher education. And clearly, India is the kind of nation, a place, a region, where indeed people have come together for millennia. And what better resource than India itself? And how much more need there is now in terms of a modern understanding of these practices and of the research in this field, that I thought we should be doing something about it. And therefore, I asked Avinash, and he really responded to this idea. And here we are 10 years later.
One thing I like is how you talk about intercultural communication competence. And some of the elements are a motivation to communicate, appropriate cultural knowledge, appropriate communication skills, sensitivity, and character. What
creates the notion of intercultural competence? Is it the idea that by understanding other cultures, and in this case, Indian culture, that one can learn from it?
Well, we can look at intercultural communication in different levels. At the most simple level, we can look at intercultural communication as communication between and among individuals from different cultures, or communication that happens among inter-ethnic, inter-religious, or even inter-regional peoples across the world.
A motivation to communicate. What do we mean by that?
At a more complex level, intercultural communication is a sub-discipline under the larger communication discipline, which seeks to understand how people from different cultures act, perceive, and understand the world around them. And this is where I think the motivation comes in. When we say we want to engage in a dialogue with the person who is different from our culture, we have to not only take into consideration our own perception of the world, but also the perception of the world from the other person's point of view, from the other person's culture's point of view. And this is where intercultural communication research is important, to understand how people from different cultures can communicate with each other.
One of the major components that we need to understand is not only a motivation to communicate with each other and to perceive each other in equitable ways, but also it helps to understand the history of the culture.
Yes, we cannot divorce ourselves from the community, the tribe, the society that we grew up in. And we can think, therefore, communication as a web of connections. We are very much like spiders creating verbal and non-verbal webs. That which we weave, we create a world through words, and we do it both to connect to the other as well as for our own happiness, survival even. And without this kind of connecting, we cannot make life possible. And so that is what intercultural communication is, from a contextual, historical, a societal aspect.
In a larger Indian worldview, you write about how communication is viewed as a process of achieving, and there's concepts of simplification and kindred spirit.
Correct. So from the larger Indian worldview, communication is a process of achieving simplification. So when I'm talking to you, Brad, what we are trying to do is to come to a common understanding. Conceptually, it means commonness, achieving oneness with each other through sharing our thoughts, emotions, using words, and much more. So communication goes to that basic level. The underlining point here is what we can achieve through mutual sharing, mutual understanding. If we look back into the research that has been done earlier in the Indian literature, it's called Sahadriyata, or kindred spirit. It is only due to Sahadriyata that two-way communication and mutual understanding are possible in a society which has many, many asymmetrical relationships.
Help us understand how that differs from a Western perspective.
Here again, we have to be careful about where we overlap and where we are different in terms of our approaches to understanding the self, the individual, and our connection to the other and to the outer. Avinash mentioned sahrudaya. It comes from a combination of two words. Basically, hrudaya, or heart, or soul, or consciousness, and saha is oneness. And this goes back to the traditional Indian understanding of the nature of the human being, of human conscience. If you go back to the Indian original texts, and if we look at the first one, the Rig Veda, in no other major text in the world, there is a discussion of the mind. It's all about God, it's about creation in so many days, or the nature of human being in terms of conquering one another, changing one another, and so on. But in the Rig Veda, there is a mention of the mind on almost every page. So it means that the Indian sages, the Indian quest for a knowledge of the self, goes back to those ancient times where the rishis, the sages, try to understand the nature of human consciousness. And that, I believe, is the magic of Indian thought, of the Indian perception about how we human beings seek to make connections between the one individual and the cosmic whole, or as some people have said, between the Atman and Brahman, Atman the individual soul, the Brahman the cosmic being.
So the focus here is on the development of self, as Ramesh was saying. At the individual level, much of the energy was spent, much of the thinking, if you go back 4,000, 5,000 years ago to the ancient Saraswati civilization, it was a very advanced civilization. As we mentioned in our second chapter there, we trace the history of the roots of Indian cultural evolution. In the Saraswati civilization, a lot of thinking was going on to know oneself. And the idea behind that was, if we know oneself, then we can relate to the larger world, the larger cosmic world. So the focus, you know, there were a lot of thinking going on in terms of what are our duties, our responsibilities towards ourselves, and then to the larger social groups that we are engaged in, our family, our community. And so this is where I think intercultural communication comes into play, to understand this aspect and then how it relates to the larger world. That is the foundation of Indian culture, and surprisingly, it has stayed the same way even now, even after so many years, so many millennia. The core elements what were developed in the Saraswati civilization, they have managed to survive even after many invasions, many cultural impacts on the Indian subcontinent. The core elements are still there, I feel.
And maybe you can help us a little bit just historically. So one thing I found fascinating, and kind of knew this, but there were extremely advanced cities with respect to drainage, art, culture, music. Everything was extraordinarily advanced as far back as 3300 BCE.
And even mathematics. A whole lot of these areas, scientific developments were taking place there. And if you look at the Harappan civilization, some of the cities, the Mohenjo-Daro, which is now in Pakistan, you could see a very astute thinking and planning in terms of sanitation, in terms of cleanliness, in terms of geometry, the designs of the houses that were done. So it was a very advanced civilization. And obviously, because of natural calamities, I think that civilization, the river dried up. And so it was not a mythical river as it used to be. It was a living river. But a lot of things happened on that river, which you can see, which are manifested in the day-to-day culture of today's Indian society.
So the name of the river was the Saraswati River?
Correct.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Avinash Tambre and Ramesh Rao talk about intercultural communications, the Indian context. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to Avinash Tambre and Ramesh Rao talk about intercultural communication, the Indian context. There's so much in your book about the notion of the river as a metaphor and the notion of the river as a real place.
I think in any society, and especially now, there are these kinds of challenges in terms of both tracing back history, writing about the past, claiming the truth, and so on. And this is something that maybe we should emphasize. Scholars have said India has no history. It only has myths, because the tradition of jotting down specifics, especially in terms of the Western tradition, seems not to be there in the Indian tradition. India, like many other ancient civilizations, was an oral culture we do have history, but then the nature of the historical telling and the ends of those tellings are very different. Here in the West, and especially in terms of maybe the Abrahamic religions, history is a source for claiming the truth. There is one truth, and that we will claim, and therefore we will claim certain kinds of advantages or supremacies so that we can establish our truth. Whereas in the Indian tradition, it has always been that there are many truths, and the way we understand and the way we develop humanity is through the kinds of lessons that we can understand from the classic struggles of human beings. So if we read the Mahabharata or the Ramayana, the specifics about when it happened, where it happened, and who won are important, but not as important as the lessons that humanity can learn from these human struggles. And I think that's very important. And so to connect to the Saraswati River, the Saraswati is now surely established by both anthropologists, archaeologists, and some modern surveys done using space technology. The dry riverbed clearly shows the direction of the flow of the Saraswati River. So it is no longer a myth, as the British historians had claimed. So we are now, I think, fairly clear that the Saraswati is no longer a mythical river. It did indeed flow.
There were also great influences in India throughout history. Could you talk about how, in a lot of ways, this is truly a melting pot culture?
Correct. So in the second chapter of the book, after we point out the things that happened on the banks of Saraswati River and the civilization that developed, then after the river dried up because of possibly, I think the evidence is that it was a massive earthquake that happened or something of that sort, after that, people from that river dispersed to other rivers like the Ganga, the Yamuna and other rivers in the greater North Indian plains. And from there, people started moving to other parts of India. So the civilization did not flower or did not survive in Saraswati River area, but it spread throughout the whole subcontinent. And after that, there was a series of intercultural contacts or invasions, so to speak, which happened from the northern side of India. So we have the Mongoloids coming in. If you look at the 5th and 6th centuries, we have the Mongoloid groups came in, then the Shakas, then the Greeks came in. They had their influence. The Huns, the Arabs were there. Persians came in from a lot of people from Iran, ruled India for 200-300 years. Then the Turks, Mongols, and down to the recent time when we have the French, the Portuguese, and last but not the least, the English, ruled India for 200-300 years. And each of these different sets of people brought in their influences, their culture. And what started there was a process of amalgamation, acculturation. So when two cultures meet, there was a lot of power struggle, but at the same time, there was syncretization, a mixing of culture, creolization, so to speak, and a fusion of these elements resulted in this pan-Indian culture that we see and witness today in day-to-day modern India.
Ramesh, you talk a lot in the book about immigration and migrant groups. Could you contextualize that for us with respect to your own book and the notion of how these migrant groups created communicative forces that were really varied?
Indeed. I think the process of adapting and interacting among these various groups, those who had already established themselves there, as well as newer groups who came both to trade and to invade, has led to the kind of characteristic diversity and what Avinash mentioned as the kind of creolization and the syncretism and the composite cultural traditions that makes modern India what it is. Also, if you look at, for example, Hinduism as a religion, though many of my friends, scholars have argued that to say Hinduism is a religion is to fall into the trap of the monotheistic religions and their historical claims to certain understanding of their own gods and claims to truth. But because of the syncretism, because of the, if I might, the kind of original, traditional understanding of the nature of the human quest, going back to the idea of sahrudaya, to make everyone belong, we now therefore have this deities, we say 33,000 gods, the variety of sects, the numerous languages, the kinds of ideas, cultural, civilizational, these are the kinds of influences that clearly, I think we can conclude that since ancient times, the Indian civilization has been pluralistic, accepting of diversity, and, you know, we can trace it back to the ancient Vedic times, but that is what is India right now.
And, of course, the great influence of the British colonial era.
Absolutely. In the last 300-400 years, and the British left in 1947, before that, there was a biggest influence we can see in terms of what India is right now, in terms of education, in terms of the infrastructure that was created by British, especially the education system, helped India to connect with the larger world. Even though it was the world's biggest economy and it had this influence, now we are back to more integration with the larger world because of these influences.
How would you both argue that knowing this history, or knowing the history of any culture when we're dealing with any intercultural communication, is very important for both the receiver and sender, helps us understand each other more effectively?
I suppose, and this is very important, especially as we live in a world that seems to be full of conflict, full of challenges, it is important to know the other, to understand the other, to live with the other, to more specifically know that our perception of the world is not singular. For example, we have this wonderful, for the lack of any other term, religion or faith group, the Jains in India, of the four major religious traditions. Jainism is one. And the Jains have this concept of anekantavada. Aneka, many, anta, ends, vada is argument or position. And what they mean by that is that for any particular issue, there are a variety of ways of approaching it, understanding it, and working with it. And I think that is maybe the singular contribution of the Indian tradition, not to make these kinds of monopolistic claims over truth. If the world has to learn anything from India, that is it. That the world that we live in is maya, illusion, in the sense that we are creating it through words, through images. It's not that our physical world is not there, but we are creating these worlds individually, and therefore we have to understand each other. We have to stop making those kinds of claims to truth that have led to the kinds of terrible conflicts around the world.
And to add to Ramesh, the history part, the understanding of history, because communication, when we talk to each other, doesn't happen in isolation. It goes back, way back to history. So we bring back all that cultural baggage, historical baggage that we have to the present day conversation. So understanding the importance of history to know what went on and bringing that context to the present communication helps us to understand each other more.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Avinash Tambre and Ramesh Rowu talk about intercultural communications, the Indian context.
And so if you take into consideration the entire gamut of things that have happened in the past, then possibly it is not very difficult to understand each other. We can know that where you are coming from and where I am coming from, and then we can establish a common ground. So in my classes, when I teach intercultural communication, the first thing that we do is to visit the history and kind of trace it out and then figure our position in this world in that context.
To understand any culture, we must first talk about the value systems of that culture. What are some of the value systems in Indian culture that may well differ from Western culture?
Going to the traditional Indian texts, we know that they emphasize harmony with all forms of life. Sarve jana sukhino bhavantu. Let everyone be happy, which means that we need to take care of not everyone in terms of just human beings, but the world around us. Therefore, harmony with all forms of life. Also, the idea of sustaining life. And that then can be connected to the modern condition where we are now, all of us, talking about the environment, sustainable living, healthy living. That is very much one of the values, and I will leave it to Avinash to point out the other fundamental values from the Indian traditions.
So yes, to elaborate on the Indian value system, I think the core elements which were developed back in the Saraswati era, as Ramesh was saying, peaceful coexistence with ourselves and the larger world. And that goes a lot into spirituality elements. So in terms of understanding ourselves, I think the core value that was being talked about there was about knowing oneself. And there were various means that were employed to do that. So in yoga, if you look at yoga, which was developed back in that era, and meditation, aspects of meditation. So they try to probe this value system where what it means to be alive and what is your presence in the world and how can that be used to seek prosperity for yourself and the larger world. So one of the core elements is spirituality. The family elements, how to relate to the larger world. So harmony, as Ramesh was telling, harmony with all forms of life. In the modern day, it has become even more important when we look at the environmental issues that we are facing now as a world, the climate change issues. I think sustainable living was emphasized and was sought to be the first thing that we need to do in terms of day-to-day living. And adherence to simplicity, avoiding waste, reverence to Mother Earth, these elements have somehow become even more important, even though now that it slowly started eroding because of the Western influences that is happening on the Indian system now. But those were the core elements that we lay out in our book.
And you talk a little bit about the split where younger generations are having a conflict between modernity and tradition. You see that with elements of marriage, or maybe even relationships to elders. Could you talk about that a little bit, Ramesh? I found that fascinating. And, you know, as more contemporary films are dealing with this conflict that folks have, I think, between tradition and modernity.
Yeah, and I think I need to provide a context for that too. Surely, I think in terms of the challenge that we all now face in these troubled times, and not that there was no trouble in the past, as one of the Indian gurus would say, tell me in which year of the past 5,000 years of recorded history there was not a war. Our struggle to find peace and pursue the spiritual, you know, surely is tested by the lure of glitter and gold. As one of the other gurus of modern time, Ramakrishna Paramahamsa, would say. But I think this we should see within the context of Indian wisdom that has pointed out that these human challenges are not new. So, for example, we have this idea that human beings have four ends in life or goals in life. We call those purusharthas, and that is kama, artha, dharma, and moksha. Kama is the sensual pleasure, whether it is sex or whether it is owning a BMW, that is part of kama. Artha, the pursuit of wealth, property, power, to be guided by dharma. Yes, we all have these desires, but these desires should be controlled and guided by dharma, which is again another Sanskrit word that is very difficult to translate, but we can say the rule of law or goodness or cosmic order, which means that in every phase of our life, and there are the four phases of life that we point out, starting with brahmacharyashrama, that is, after we are born, to follow through our childhood and our education. Then grihasthashrama, the phase of domesticity, of getting married, having children, building a home, pursuing those artha and kama parts of it. To what ends? To pursue moksha, liberation from this cycle of birth and death. And for that, we do that in the last two phases of letting go. After one establishes family and sees her and his children grow up, to let go and to go in pursuit of knowledge. Indians are seekers. They are not merely believers.
This is Arts and Letters. We're listening to Avinash Tambre and Ramesh Rahul talk about intercultural communications, the Indian context. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Arts and Letters. Let's return to Avinash Tambre and Ramesh Rahul talk about intercultural communication, the Indian context.
You talk a little bit about the split where younger generations are having a conflict between modernity and tradition. You see that with elements of marriage or maybe even relationships to elders. Could you talk about that a little bit?
India is considered to be a very collectivistic culture. It was a collectivistic culture, and now there is these influences that are happening from all parts of the world, especially about individualism. So when individualism and collectivism collide with each other, so where is that boundary line? That's where I think the struggle that is happening in India right now and other parts of the world. How much should you pursue your own goals, your own desires in terms of achieving the wealth and the other elements that you have, to balance that, that's where I think a lot of testament to Indian culture would be coming through, because there is no ideal way to handle this. We mentioned about challenges that are happening, especially with arranged marriages. When I teach my intercultural communication class, the first thing that they ask is, was your marriage arranged? And I say, yes, it was arranged. And the concept, the stereotype that most of the students in my class have is that I have no freedom. When I got married, my parents told that you have to marry this girl, and that was it. I had no choice. That is a stereotype I feel very permanent. It's there in the larger Western society. But if you go back to India and you see that, that is not really true, because there is a lot of freedom for both the girl and the boy to negotiate when it comes to marriage. There is a lot of things that happen. There's a lot of feedback that has been taken into consideration by the parents before a marriage happens. And arranged marriages kind of emphasize more on the collectivistic side of the culture. What is best for your family in terms of this alliance that you have with your partner? What is the collective good that comes out of it? Or should you just pursue a love in its purest sense and say, well, I really love this person and I don't care about my family. I don't care about what values the other person brings into my family, but I'm just going to marry this person. So there's this struggle which I think every younger Indian person is facing. And as the other challenges that have been faced by Indian culture, I think this is one challenge that is going to evolve. I feel personally that a balance will be achieved between the individual goals of a person and the larger collective goals.
And I would be remiss, Amish, if I did not just ask you to touch a little bit on cosmology, the scientific study of large-scale properties in the universe as a whole. And I know you deal in that chapter with cosmology. Not easy to do quickly, but I'm just interested a little bit in why the fascination from your perspective in cosmology with respect to even the question, who is an Indian?
I would like to plug Robert Colasso's book. He's this fascinating, learned man, Italian, who's written books about Western civilization and so on, but who has also been very curious about India, and his book called Ardor, A-R-D-O-R. And he basically traces in this book about this ancient Indian quest to understand cosmic order, O-R-D-E-R, through ardor, A-R-D-O-R, ardor in terms of the Indian word that he translates is tapas, T-A-P-A-S. This focus in creating simple fire altars, A-L-T-A-R-S, and to go through a careful, studied approach to making sense of the conscious life with this grand universe. And I think that has been the Indian contribution to the world. So if we look at the Indian conception of time, unlike the biblical claims of the world being created in 6 days and God resting on the seventh and so on and so forth, one half year of Brahma is many, many billions of years. And after that is over, it repeats. That is the grand scheme. And of course, modern physicists, astronomers have pointed this out. Whatever the scale of the cosmos, both in terms of times as well as space, literally into the trillions of years and trillions of light years and so on and so forth. And that surely is the influence on Hindu Indian cosmology, and that which gives the Indian the kind of focus on life and the pursuit of life to therefore understand this grand cosmic design.
I love some of the quotations in your book, and I just want to read one. The present and past are imagined as a microcosm of time in the infinite expanse of eternity. What about time orientation in Indian culture is emphasized here?
This is, I think, the fascinating part of Indian tradition, which is the combination of both philosophical pursuit and faith and practice. The whole idea of historical time, linear time, is a Western modern concept that has led us to a lot of conflict. The idea of cyclical or cyclical time is very much an Indian concept, one could even say an Eastern concept, where it is not either or, the past, present, and future, but both, and the past, present, and future present all the time, which is not merely mental gymnastics, but experienced life. If we think about how our own lives are guided, then the past, the present, and future are there in the present, even as we are talking with one another. The idea is to come to the understanding that the individual self and the cosmic self are one and the same, and that it takes time, and the time is not a few years, but a few lifetimes.
I'd like to just talk about conflict, because you write a whole chapter about conflict and avoiding conflict, but by avoidance, I mean accepting it, but also trying to understand how to deal with it. Reading this book helped me understand ways of thinking about dealing with conflict in much more productive ways than we otherwise often do. Could you talk a little bit about how the concept of intercultural communication, particularly what we've discussed, its historical notions, its value system, understanding the culture, and understanding language and myth, reality, stereotypes, everything that we've discussed, how that might help us deal with conflict?
I usually tell in my class about notions of when two different cultures come in contact with each other. What happens is it starts with a misunderstanding of each other. So when a particular culture comes into contact with another particular culture, and obviously the two cultures are different, their value systems are different, their understanding, the perception of the world, on the surface level, the language is different. So when it comes to conflict, I think that's the notion that is there. When two cultures come into contact with each other, it results in misunderstanding, which results into conflict. So there is a whole lot of literature right now in terms of research that we have done in intercultural conflict. And you see in the present society, most of the flashpoints in the world are because of intercultural conflict. Mm-hmm. And so we can break it down into different conflict management strategies. What is the best thing that we can do? Or a win-win situation, win-lose situation. There's so many things that have been done there. However, I think what we emphasize in our chapter is not only the strategies that are out there, but also understanding each other from the point of other person's perception.
Baby, if you come back, prick me with the thumbtack, hit me with the great digger stone that you can. Punch me with a clenched fist, overcook my breakfast, darling, if you come on back.
And that would be what is needed right now in India too, because in India, we have different subcultures within our cultures. within our the main Indian, pan-Indian culture, and then we break it down, there is every single part, region has this own culture. So to bridge that gap, I think more understanding beyond language, beyond the superficial things that we emphasize, obviously the power issue is always there when we have communication between two different cultures. The power issue comes in, and the misunderstanding comes in from not knowing the other person's language.
Darling, if you come home and do whatever you want, you know you won't be hearing no fuss about it. Two rocks of deep dirt, begging till my knees hurt, baby, if you come on back home. Darling, can't you hear the nights dark quiet? Can't you feel the days cold? I can feel it coming on like a riot. Darling, won't you come on back home?
So these elements are there, but understanding each other's value system and our place in the world and our place in the larger cosmos, if we start from that viewpoint, then most of our cultural conflicts don't make sense.
Baby, when you ain't near, nothing in my life's clear. I don't even know the first thing about living. I'm a truck without a trailer, suit without a tailor. Baby, won't you come on back home? Darling, can't you hear the nights dark quiet? Can't you feel the days cold? I can feel it coming on like a riot. Darling, won't you come on back home?
So it sounds to me like if we help each other to understand history, if we understand value systems, and if we understand language and the context of language with respect to culture, then maybe we can get along.
Correct.
To end, how can listeners apply knowledge about intercultural communication?
We will point out that communication skills are intrinsically related to the culture that we grew up in and that we belong to, and that as we build alliances with people across our communities, we should engage in the kind of affirmation of life in general and of each other's worth in particular. And what this means is that we should acknowledge that we can surely encounter difficulties in our relationships based on our status, values, and life orientations. How we acknowledge and reconcile with these differences surely will affect the quality of our intercultural relationships and alliances. And it is important, as intercultural communication scholars point out, about ethnocentrism. Ethnocentrism is all about claiming a superior status. As soon as I claim superior status, then I'm putting the other one at a lower level. So the idea of acceptance and celebration can only come when we can understand that we are human beings of equal status. And that, I think, is very much part of our agenda in writing this book. And I'll leave it to Avinash to share his thoughts about it.
Sure. And to add to what Ramesh said, we in the last chapter try to summarize what we can learn from this research that we have in front of us. And we cannot think of any other important way to handle the intercultural communication conflicts that are going on and engage in intercultural competence. And one way to do that is to engage in a true dialogue. True dialogue which enables us to connect with each other, to understand each other. Going back to the concept of Sahidrya Kiran, if we can connect to each other, engage in creating interpersonal allies, so to speak, that's what we say here, to forge a new way of unity. Even though there are plenty of differences, not focus on the contradictory nature of each other that we have, but focus on the unity part. If we can do that by engaging in a true dialogue, building alliances, affirming each other, as Ramesh was pointing out, we would be heading into a direction where we can create a more balanced world, more engaging world, more sustainable world. These are the things that we lay out in the last chapter.
And if we can understand each other's perspectives, we can bring about a positive change.
Correct. And to understand each other, that needs a lot of motivation. That needs a lot of attitude change with ourselves. Behaviors, skills, and willingness to understand each other's perspective, which will ultimately lead to positive change, social change at the individual level, at the larger human level. But forgiveness to ourselves, to those who have suffered discrimination, oppression, violence, abuse, that needs a lot of motivation. It needs to be earned and learned at the same time. And it is a process.
Thank you so much, Ramesh. Thank you, Avinash. I learned so much from your book.
Thank you, Brad.
Thank you very much for your kind words.
Broadcast from the studios of KUAR in Little Rock, you've been listening to Arts and Letters. Thanks for joining us. To check out past episodes, go to artsandlettersradio.org. Thank you to Indian scholar and musician Trigun Maru for the ragas. Thank you to musicians, singers, and songwriters, the Rad Trads.
Baby, if you come back, prick me with the thumbtack, hit me with the great bigger stone.
Thank you to Akila Thurum Alareddy, Amar Kanakar, and Mary Ellen Cubitt for the invaluable guidance, consultation, and advice. Thank you to Mr. Michael Hiblin, who recorded the show and was instrumental in its coming to fruition. Thank you to Sticky's Rock and Roll Chicken Shack for keeping music alive and well in Arkansas. Generous funding for Arts and Letters was provided by the Arkansas Humanities Council and the National Endowment for the Humanities. Thank you to writers and speech communication professors Ramesh Raul and Avinash Tambre for their invaluable intercultural walk through Indian history and culture in an effort to help us all understand that through the application of intercultural communication, we can dismantle any real or perceived barrier and maybe, just maybe, heal our disparate and fractious world. For Arts and Letters, I'm J. Bradley Menick. Let's heed the words of Mahatma Gandhi. Happiness is when what you think, what you say, and what you do are in harmony.